Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host today, Kirk Cahoon.
And I'm David Narum of Greenway Partners. One of the things Kirk and I have been talking about over the last year or so on the Eco News Report is the role of innovation and how people's ingenuity can help with solving environmental problems. And as anybody that's creating or trying to solve a problem will tell you, that one of the important pieces of solving the puzzle is having good information to work with. And sometimes it requires going out and getting it. Other times it's just figuring out who's got it and getting it from them, or creating your own. Whatever the case, information can help produce outcomes that are defensible and that have relevance to the problems at hand. Now, for example, we're talking today with Becky Price Hall of the Humboldt Bay Initiative. This is an ecosystem-based initiative which takes a big picture look at some of the impacts on the bay. Now, in order to resolve some of these impacts and understand how the system works together, we need good information.
And sometimes, David, information isn't really enough. You need, and information can't be produced in a vacuum. You have obviously certain biases that come with when you develop the resources to study and get information. So when we start looking at an ecosystem-based management approach, information is only part of the picture. There's also the human system that's necessary to involve, the political system, and the social system. So how have people lived around Humboldt Bay for the last thousands of years, and how will the management of this ecosystem in a more systemic way be affected when we start changing the way things we've done things over the last hundreds and thousands of years?
And changing the way we've done things, I mean, think about the term innovation as less as a specific, say, technology innovation, but as a different and better way of doing things. People have always responded to their environment and to the available information at hand to figure out better ways of doing things. It's just sort of the human predicament and our adaptability, which allows us to respond to the needs of a changing world by innovating creative solutions. And one of the things I'd like to mention is that this summer, speaking of a resilient society that responds to changing conditions, whether they're economic conditions or environmental or social or whatever. But this summer, there's going to be a conference put on by Planet Green, a well-known local nonprofit, regarding resilience and adaptation to climate change. For more information about the conference, it's one word, HumboldtPlanetGreen.org is the source of information for this conference coming up in July. And there's still time to actually get involved with conference organizing and volunteering to help out. And so just go to the HumboldtPlanetGreen.org website for more information on that.
And we talk about resilience and adaptation, David. Necessity is the mother of invention. And so often we find ourselves responding to a crisis in a way that's very short term and very panicky and very reactionary. And what I think systems in this country or in this part of the world specifically have gotten more attuned to is being more proactive and looking down the road a little bit further. And certainly that has not been the case in addressing climate change, but it is obviously that issue is appearing more and more real for more and more people. It certainly seems like time to get off our stick and do something about it.
Yes, I think a part of a good innovator's toolkit is an ability to at least somewhat see into the future and predict what's going to happen, whether you're a business person looking for that future trend that you're going to capitalize on, or a resource manager looking for that future potential harmful impact that you need to deal with.
Yeah. And we are on the phone today with Becky Price Hall, a watershed coordinator for the city of Trinidad. And we are speaking today about the Humboldt Bay Initiative. Welcome, Becky.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, great. Well, so Becky, you've got this Humboldt Bay Initiative project that you're working on, and I kind of wonder if you can give us just a big picture view. What is it we're talking about here, aside from Humboldt Bay?
We're talking about a group of resource managers, scientists, industry people, and organizations that are interested in promoting ecosystem-based management around Humboldt Bay.
Okay, and why would that be important?
A lot of different agencies are really involved in different aspects of the Bay and the Bay Area. Department of Fish and Game has their areas of interest in the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then cities such as Arcata and Eureka have their concerns. And if all these groups can together in their planning and implementation of projects, then everyone gains, resources are shared, and basically it works better for everybody.
But maybe talk a little bit, just some of the history of the way it's been used, some of the impacts, the way it's being used now, some of the bigger picture kind of ideas that people have for where it should go. Should it be an industrial port? Should it be, managed differently?
Yeah, you've kind of identified that there are both the sort of economic and social things that we want in Humboldt Bay, but we also want to maintain a viable environment. We want fish, we want birds and clean water.
What about the way the bay is being managed now needs to change?
Seems like there has been difficulty in the past with people who are interested in doing development around the bay or doing fishing or changing things. They have been sometimes in conflict with people who want to protect the environment. So hopefully through this process, those people can talk and work out ways forward that both protect the environment and secure our economic health in this area.
So, in other words, there's a conflict that's not uncommon in any area besides Humboldt Bay, people that want to protect the environment and people that may want to develop something that may have an impact on the environment. There's always that conflict, it seems, inherent in a lot of projects. So is what you're proposing here or what you're working on through Humboldt Bay Initiative a different way of doing business? Is that what we're hearing?
I would say so, yes.
Okay.
Because I think there's a lot of opportunities where you can find solutions that both protect the environment and continue to provide opportunities for fishermen, ranchers, cities to do what they need to do to provide things for the citizens.
I was looking through the information on the Humboldt Bay Initiative that you provided, and one piece is the Coastal Ecosystems Institute of Northern California.
Yes.
And the mission of that being to develop, integrate, disseminate scientific information. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that sort of aspect of this, and then maybe lead into kind of a discussion of ecosystem-based management so we can explain to our listeners what that means. But the role of the Humboldt Bay Initiative seems to be really a science-oriented approach.
Yes, and I think what we're trying to do is collect the science that we have and find out what we still don't know and use that to make good decisions. I think there's a lot of people doing like water quality monitoring, and sometimes one group will be monitoring and another group will be monitoring, and they don't know that they're both doing basically the same thing. So some of it is actually doing studies, but a lot of what both the Coastal Ecosystems Institute and HBI are trying to do is not duplicate efforts in science, but just make what has been done more accessible to resource managers and city personnel and ranchers and fishermen.
What about Humboldt Bay is unique? It's the second largest estuary in California, natural estuary in California. But what else about the bay is so unique?
Well, it supports a lot of different aquatic creatures. It, as probably your listeners know, there's a thriving oyster industry, so clean water is very important for that industry. It's a nursery for Dungeness crab and salmon and many other fish. There are large eelgrass beds, which birds that fly from Alaska down south, they'll stop in that Black Brant's one. Of course, the geese that everyone has seen in our pastures around the bay. So it's a very diverse, rich environment.
And the bay has also been, obviously, the location of a number of our most industrial facilities in Humboldt Bay over the years or around this region.
Right.
But it's interesting. Most recently, I finished a book of history, and the Mad River at one point was connected to the bay by a canal.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a large source of some of the sediment that still exists in our bay going back, 70, 80, 100 years, more than 100 years. But a lot of the creeks that enter the bay, Salmon Creek, Jacoby Creek, and others, brought a lot of sediment from hillsides that were subjected to logging. We're still seeing those impacts to the bay, aren't we?
Yes, that's a good question. That we know that sediment is not good for salmon and other creatures in the creeks. It's been assumed that it's not good in the bay. And I think the sediment that's in the water, clouding the water, is what's mostly harmful. We do have dredging issues, but some of the people who are studying it are not sure if it's coming in the mouth of the bay or if that sediment that's been washed down the creeks.
Speaking of data and reading through the material again, talking about its value for communication purposes, what sort of key indicators do you look for, say, for example, sediment or, if you're talking about the oyster industry, what sort of parameters from environmental health are important to keep in mind and to communicate to the public and decision makers?
I would have to say, I know eelgrass needs light. This is just an example. If there's too much suspended sediment in the water, the diminished light reduces its productivity.
So there's a considerable amount of research going on regarding the health of the eelgrass beds and monitoring?
Yeah, but not just for the eelgrass, but, it's important for the oysters. Now, oysters need nutrients from the water, and so some of what's in the water is their food, the toxic things obviously would not be good for them or for us to eat them.
I'm wondering if you can answer a question for me. This is a philosophical question. I think a lot of people that are working outside of science, perhaps, or just interested in the health of the environment, they would be very somewhat confused by our approaches to natural resource management in the past, and it's not been apparently science-based, and it's becoming more science-based, but we still see some of the same decisions and some of the same impacts and some of the same disruptions to the environment, whether it's science-based or not. So I'm always wondering, you know, how effective does science-based management make change happen? Is it effective at helping change the way things are managed, in your opinion?
That's a very difficult question. Part of it is there's the whole realm of science, and, you know, it's a balancing act of good for one thing may not be good for another thing. But then on the other side of that is the whole decision-making process, and there's so much more that goes into a decision than just the facts. You know, even if you're basing it on facts, you still have to make a trade-off between the fishermen and the logging issues, like we're talking about sediment. You know, it's a balancing act, and so it's kind of a bigger problem than just basing things on science.
Well, I guess, for me, the question and the quote that comes to mind is, people are entitled to their own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own facts. The idea of science's appearance is to give us facts, is to give us a place at which we can make decisions that are based on factual findings. But when you study science, when you go to graduate school, when you do work in the field in science, you find that it's not really that clear cut all the time, is it?
No. And I guess one of the reasons I am interested in working with the Humboldt Bay Initiative is that they're really interested in looking at kind of the big picture, how all these things fit together. It's really easy to be just studying one narrow topic scientifically, but it's not in the context of the whole bay. And I think it's easy to not understand the whole question.
And I think that's probably a good segue into discussion of what sort of the ecosystem-wide approach means, you know, looking at things from a systems perspective, how things impact one another and synergize and sort of spin off. I know that the ecosystem-based management is an approach that's been applied elsewhere. How is it being applied? Or maybe first define it and talk about how it's being approached here.
So ecosystem-based management is trying to look at the whole, and it's trying to acknowledge that people are part of the ecosystem as well. So it's not simply looking at a single species or all fish or all plants, but it's looking at how human beings and the natural system can work together well and have healthy human communities and have a healthy ecosystem.
So it's sort of viewing the human systems as a part of the natural systems and figuring out how they can work together.
Right. Because I think sometimes we just look at what a healthy ecosystem would be if in a, like, totally quote-unquote natural state, but we don't sort of say, well, we live here, we have to make our living.
Right.
Well, so what sort of changes are on the horizon for Humboldt Bay? We see a gigantic looming ball of concern and worry and fear out there in the form of climate change with very uncertain effects and at some future time scale. But those of us that are actually paying close attention to the bay have noticed changes already.
That's right. Like, for instance, around kind of near Jacoby Creek, Highway 101 has been flooded a couple times. And that was, you know, in conjunction with a large storm. But it does make us think about it, about what rising sea levels will do. I guess I would say to people, sort of stay tuned, because I don't think it's at all clear if what, you know, we think about rising sea level, we just think of it kind of a bathtub getting more and more full. But here on the North Coast, we also have a lot of tectonic activity. So I don't think we know what it's going to look like.
But we can make a conjecture that on a day where the high tide used to be 7.8 and now it's 9.8, and we have a storm with a 30-foot swell out of the harbor and the, you know, creeks are all flooding into the bay, that we're talking about a significant amount of flooding over and above what we're seeing in dates, you know, current times right now.
Yeah, I would say that's correct.
Okay. So the predicted management, how do you plan for something like that? That's an uncertainty in the future, and that's one of the big challenges of any ecosystem-based management approach, is there are enormous uncertainties.
It's a huge challenge, and one of the things that the Humboldt Bay Initiative is working on right now is trying to develop a model for, say, let's just say for the cities to look at, okay, if this is what the projecting sea level are going to be doing. What's vulnerable in our city? Is our sewage treatment plant vulnerable? What areas are potentially going to flood? So I think right now, it's regardless of the timing, we're just saying, well, what might it look like?
And by vulnerable, can you define that? It's not like they need a hug or, you know, a cookie and a glass of milk. It's there are threats to its failure is really what we're talking about.
If your house is at a very low elevation and you already have some flooding at very high tides, you might assume that you may have increasing problems with flooding in the future. And if it was me, I would feel vulnerable. And so what can I do in that situation?
What sort of things can, I mean, I was talking about diverse collaborations that the initiative is a part of helping to form among scientists, resource managers, populations of some disadvantaged populations, students, landowners, et cetera, and so forth. What sort of things might a landowner who's living along the bay look for regarding the Humboldt Bay Initiative or be able to take part in?
Well, there certainly will be information that will be available, and it is to some extent, you know, some of our documents are available now. But I think as we have more information, we plan to make it available to a general audience as well as for planners around the bay.
Okay. And what do you do with in the scenario that I'm going to present you? I'm wondering how you're going to take this. But if you look at the situation where people are being evacuated out of a disaster zone, you're always going to find five or six people that don't want to leave. Right? They don't want to leave their home. This is where they live their whole life, 30, 40 years or whatever. And when we talk about the way people have been managing land around Humboldt Bay for, and probably a similar scenario, 30, 40 years, 100 years, whatever it is, their family's been there, we're talking about a significant change to that way of management as a result of climate change, adapting to climate change, sea level rise, whatever. How do you approach working with landowners that have maybe that sort of historical legacy?
I guess the Humboldt Bay Initiative isn't necessarily the group that's in the position to do that, aside from providing information. It would be the responsibility maybe of the cities or the county. But to the extent that the cities and the counties and the landowners can work together, they can figure out how they want to go forward. You know, right now we have kind of budget difficulties with, you know, the cities and the county and the state. And so, you know, that factors in as well to what can we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people suggest, well, we can raise the levies, and well, can we? And so there's a lot of questions that everyone will have to work together to figure out the solution that's going to work.
Right. And I think the value of the data monitoring it in part is at least to, even if it doesn't pan out the way the predictions are, at least you have the sense of maybe some of the considerations that you need to think about. You know, if something happens, these are the things. So you come from policy and planning from a more prepared perspective, data-driven perspective than you would otherwise.
That's right.
You're listening to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host, Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners. Joining me in the studio is David Narum of Greenway Partners, and we are speaking with Becky Price Hall of the City of Trinidad. She's a watershed coordinator working on the Humboldt Bay Initiative project. So, Becky, I'm wondering if you can give us an overview of your strategies that Humboldt Bay Initiative is going to be taking going forward.
Sure. These strategies were developed in 2009. We had a large meeting with many people in the area who were doing planning and came up with sort of that group's top priorities. And the first strategy is not so much related to the environment, but it was related to how was this Humboldt Bay Initiative going to go forward. And they felt that having some sort of formal organization, would be helpful. So we have worked to develop the Coastal Ecosystems Institute of Northern California, which is basically a research institute to pull together information.
Okay, so your first strategy is to develop a body to work on these issues. What's your second strategy?
Correct. So the second strategy is a coordinated response to coastal and climate change. And in that strategy, we would be synthesizing and providing the most recent information to scientists and managers and the public of information that's already out there. And with that information, begin to try and understand what the potential impacts of climate variability and climate change would be on the infrastructure around the bay and human activities and on the impacts on the environment.
You brought up sort of this coordination, and it seems to me, you know, a data-driven kind of effort, science-based, you're going to end up with sort of a sea of information. And you probably are already aware of a multitude of sources of information that are just kind of scattered around. Is there, I mean, I believe part of this effort is just this coordinating this great sea of information and trying to make sense of it.
Yeah. We just are kind of wrapping up a project where we collected all the different sources of data that we could and kind of filtered through them and sorted and prioritized them and group them into categories, and that is available to anyone who's interested. It's not all the data, but it's kind of the sources of data.
It directs them to the sources, yeah.
And so that would be something people could go to, sort of a, you know, a catalog, and it's annotated, so there would be enough information that you would go, oh, that's something that would really help me.
Okay, and so moving on your strategies, so you have the next strategy, which is?
Coordinated response to invasive species.
Okay, and we know those are obviously a threat to Humboldt Bay. How do they get here, invasive species?
So they get here a lot of different ways. The aquatic invasives often come when boats come, they have water sometimes in their hold, bilge water, and when they dump that out, there'll be organisms in there, or they'll suck it back in to go on to the next port. And so if we have critters here, they could be transported elsewhere. They can also come in on the feet of birds flying by. I think some seeds like Spartina can just float in the water.
That's interesting. I'd heard from a rancher a long time ago that the Spartina, which is Chilean cordgrass, came to Humboldt Bay from Chile when we were taking redwood to Chile to develop, you know, Santiago and places like that with redwood. They would bring back ballast in the form of rocks and other things that had seeds on them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, some of the rocks that you'll find around Indian Island and other places are maybe of Chilean origin. I don't know if that's true. That's a myth. Maybe.
I have heard that as well. I don't know for certain, but I do know that if, for instance, if we have one patch of it, it could spread mm-hmm. to another place around the bay, just floating in the water.
Right. And then, so moving on to your next strategy, you have an issue regarding sediment.
Sediment. So this we kind of alluded to earlier. Part of what we need to do is understand how the sediment circulates in the bay. So we're proposing a study to understand how the water in the bay circulates and how sediment is transported around the bay. And that would be integrating the water coming down in the watersheds and the sediment, and it would also look at what could potentially be coming into the mouth of the bay.
Sounds like some modeling will be happening.
Yeah.
How about the next strategy, Becky?
So the next strategy is, and some of the, I just have to back up for a minute and say that really we have worked on the first strategy, establishing that nonprofit and the coordinated response to coastal and climate change, but the others haven't really moved forward very much aside from developing some proposals. So this next one is promoting sustainable development. And so in this, we're looking at how, this could be a very big one, but we're looking at how do we promote practices around the bay that will keep pollutants out of the water courses and out of the bay.
So there you're looking at things like roads. Possibly.
Mm-hmm. And protecting
streams.
The streams and making sure we don't have failing septic systems that would get into our groundwater.
Okay. And the next strategy, I think it's the last one on the list.
Yeah. And this was developed in that strategic planning workshop, and it's supporting integrated forest management. And so this was, as we conceived it, we were interested in facilitating kind of communication between what the communities wanted and what the needs of our timber companies were. And Humboldt Bay Initiative folks haven't really tackled that one, but it is, I think,
it's kind of the elephant
being
in the room.
Actively worked on by others.
Okay. And it does seem to be like one of the big elephants in the room. Historically, the timber industry has been a big part of, obviously, resource management,
mm-hmm.
but as well as some of the dangers and threats to Humboldt Bay.
Right. But I think a lot has changed even since 2009 with this, and some of the companies have changed management, and I think people are thinking about this differently now, perhaps, to some extent. So I mean, I don't know, like the City Forest in Arcata, that's sort of a new model that people are looking at.
And let's take a big picture view here. What is the outcome that you're hoping to get with the development of all of these strategies? If these are successfully implemented, what do you anticipate having at the end of the day?
We would hope to have more fish. We would hope to have a healthy economy, you know, have our fisheries, crab and salmon be very healthy and producing good incomes for people. We would hope that our water quality be good and supporting oyster culture and our, you know, good drinking water.
I just want to go on from a personal perspective as a scientist. I was reading through some of the information again on the Coastal Ecosystem Institute, and it talks about the non-advocacy position, that we do not support proposals that take sides, and nor do we have a political or financial interest. And I'm just wondering, as a scientist and as a person, how do you deal with these kinds of, not necessarily conflicts, but just with the stance of the neutral scientist and addressing some of these issues? Or is it not an issue for you?
Okay, well, so one thing I would like to say is that I'm not a natural scientist. I'm a social scientist. So any of the really technical parts of this, I listen to, but I don't necessarily understand all the nuances.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the advocacy, non-advocacy goes, we are hoping to provide information to people that they can use.
In a nutshell, we could say that the CEINC and the Humboldt Bay Initiative are making efforts to take basic science and make sure that science is the leading part of any conversation.
That's right.
Okay.
And okay, so here is an example. Around the bay, there's a lot of ag land and pastures. And to have the good pastures, you don't want it flooded. You don't want the waste flowing into the creeks. Another thing that's important is that the tidal exchange occurs. And you can do projects that would both increase the potential of your pasture land and provide additional habitat, salt marsh or freshwater, by reconfiguring tide gates and channels. And so it actually benefits both systems.
Right. Okay.
And so we're looking for those situations where we're not saying this is important and this isn't important, or we're going to promote this but not this, but we're looking for the situations that can provide
win-wins.
Benefits
you're for
to everybody.
Yeah.
Win-win.
It's
okay.
A balance.
Good. Multiple gains.
All right.
Good.
Well, we're just about out of time today, Becky. We'd really like to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Becky.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Our guest today has been Becky Price Hall. Thank you for joining us on the Eco News. I'm Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners.
And I'm David Narum of Greenway Partners.
All right. We'll see you again next time. Bye. Thanks. Bye. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR for the Eco News Report.